All right, we're going to go ahead and get started. I think it would be, at the beginning, I think it would be helpful for us to kind of, since we're going to be starting a new section, the next two lessons are going to be dealing with the church in the modern world. And so I'm going to have to explain what I mean by that and all that kind of stuff. But it's, I think it's important for us to look over, if you want to think of big epics in church history as far as what we've talked about so far. You have the ancient church, which we would take up until, there's a lot of different ways of dating that, but the Council of Chalcedon or some of the other ones, about 600. And then you have the medieval church, which is going to come after that all the way up until the time of the Reformation. And then we've been talking for the last four or so lessons over the Reformation. And the Reformation is not that long, and a lot of what we're going to be talking about here in a lot of ways can be viewed as sort of the end push of the Reformation as it starts coming into contact with the modern world for the first time. So there are a lot of ideas that we're going to get that are the same. But so we're going to be dealing with the modern world. If we're going to talk about the beginning of the modern world, I think it's important for us to go ahead and clarify what I mean by that. And what I'm going to talk about here is really the Enlightenment as the beginning of the modern world. And it's going to be beginning in about the middle of the 17th century is where the origins of this are going to be. This is going to be a very long process. It's going to stretch over over about a century and a half. And you could even say that we're still living in a lot of ways in the Enlightenment now, as our thoughts and a lot of our ideas, and I continue to hear people express very sort of modern ideas. But beginning in the 17th century, for the first time in really over 1,000 years, a new religious or philosophical system is going to develop, is going to seriously challenge traditional Christianity and its ideas and its preconceptions and presuppositions. And what it's going to do is it's going to bring about the modern world. And at the same time, what it's going to do in doing that is going to, Christianity is going to become marginalized in this. And what we're going to have is the rise and success of rationalism, if we want to go to the next slide. So this is basically the same thing. After the rise and success of rationalism and the coming of the modern world, that's no longer going to be the case. Christianity had shaped and influenced Western culture really since the middle. I mean, you could start saying that Christianity started shaping the intellectual discussion in really the second or third century A.D., you're having Greeks and Romans that are going to have to start dealing with the ideas and thoughts posed by Christianity. And that's really where a lot of the ideas are going to be. And Christianity is going to come, and Christian thinkers and Christian philosophers are going to be the people who are really setting the tone intellectually and really driving it forward. And this is no longer going to be the case. What you're going to have developing during the time of the Enlightenment and the rise of the modern world is no longer going to be Christians that are driving this, although that's going to be the case at the beginning of this. But it's going to become more and more secularized, and it's going to be dominated by thoughts and ideas that we're going to see are not necessarily compatible with traditional Christian ideas. And this is the Enlightenment, and this is what we're going to be talking about. The origins of the Enlightenment, there are three origins of the Enlightenment that we just need to run through very quickly before we go on. And what we're going to be doing is we're going to be looking at the Enlightenment, looking at the problems that it poses for the church, and we're going to be looking at the structure of the church at the time. The church at the time that the Enlightenment was really kicking off and getting started was kind of stagnating. And then we're going to be looking at Christian responses, not just to the problems posed by the Enlightenment, but also to the problems of stagnation and different things like that. And then we're going to go on next week and really look at how the church begins to adopt certain modernist ideas and the influence that that has on the church and different things like that, and how that's played out in the last 150 or so years. So the origins of the Enlightenment really began with the Renaissance and Renaissance humanism, this return to man being the center of things. Now, this does not necessarily mean, nor was Renaissance humanism necessarily an anti-Christian idea. There are plenty of Renaissance humanists that are very devout Christians that emphasize man, the glory of man as a created being by God, and emphasize that. So we should not think of any of the first two of these, obviously. When you see the next one, you'll realize that that's not obviously not the problem either. But both of these are going to bring about, in a lot of ways, the opportunity for the Enlightenment to happen. So what Renaissance humanism is going to do, it's going to challenge and rebel against authority. So for the past 1,000 years, people have been thinking and doing things in a certain way, believing certain things. In the Renaissance, in the arts, when you start looking at arts, that's the most obvious way to see this. You look at a medieval painting, you look at a Renaissance painting, they look radically different. That's because they are challenging the presuppositional ideas of what art is supposed to be. So artists are doing that, scholars are doing that by going back and looking at sources and rewriting what the medievals would have thought about history. You can see this in things like where they go back and prove that the donation of Constantine was a forgery and other things like this. But there are other reasons besides that. The next one is going to be the Reformation. The Reformation is also going to lead to the Enlightenment. And that is another area in which authority in both thought and in practice is going to be challenged. It's going to be in theology and doctrine. And it's also going to be in liturgical and ecclesiastical practices. What we're going to have is we have a group of people that are going to take what was the established practice, mode of thought, mode of operation, and they're going to turn that upside down. And it's going to become, as we've seen over the past four lessons, more and more of a radical turning away from what had previously been the practice. And also, another way the Protestant Reformation leads to the Enlightenment is the fragmentation and conflict within Protestantism. So as Protestant groups fragmentize and break apart and kind of debate back and forth with each other, what it's going to do is it's going to encourage kind of this belief that we can't really know what the truth is, because we have all these radical different groups over here that are arguing about all these little details. If we can't know what truth is, how do we know what anything is real? And it's just kind of throw into up in the air a lot of previously held beliefs and ideas. And that's going to lead to the third. Well, this doesn't lead to it. This is just another cause of the Enlightenment, the Scientific Revolution. Now, none of these, even the Scientific Revolution, because science in and of itself is not a philosophy. It's not a religion. It's not a worldview. It's just a method. All right? It's just a method of practicing, looking at the world, experimenting, gaining knowledge. It's not a way of thinking about, you know, presuppositional kind of conceptual or philosophical ideas. That's going to come out of the Scientific Revolution. But the Scientific Revolution in and of itself does not necessarily, meaning it has to lead to the Enlightenment and to rationalism and everything else. That's not the case. There are going to be plenty of people in the Scientific Revolution that would not have been okay with that. But it's going to challenge previous authority too. People like Copernicus, Galileo, and Newton are all going to start slowly knocking out the kind of natural philosophical ideas about the natural world and the way that it worked. So, obviously the biggest one of these is obviously going to be Copernicus. Is going to start talking about no longer is the earth the center of the universe, but the sun is now the center of the universe. People like Galileo, and through the use of the telescope, is going to prove this. Galileo's also going to rewrite Aristotle's laws of motion and how things work there. So Newton's going to, and Kepler and other people are going to undergird and knock out more of Aristotle's ideas. So color theory with Newton and other things like that is going to be developed. It's going to change the way that people view the world, and what they had previously thought to be the way that the world worked, they're going to see that that's no longer the case. Okay? Now, it's important to note that all of these people were churchmen and varying forms of Christians, although you could argue that Newton moves outside the realm of traditional orthodoxy as he denies the Trinity and a number of ideas. But regardless of the fact, they all have a belief in God. They're not atheistic. They're not anything like that. Also, the Scientific Revolution is going... No, back a little bit more. One more. There you go. Is going to create the rise of empiricism, which is the belief that the only way to understand the world is through our senses. And that means that we have to be able to believe that what our senses are experiencing is real and it's reality. So these are kind of ideas, and that would not necessarily have always been pre-scientific revolution type of thing. There have been plenty of times where people would have doubted that their senses, what they saw, were real, and would have thought that that might not be the case. So a lot of ideas if you want to think about this. Another one of the ways that we're going to see this is of the case, the way that they understand the physical world is through math. So Galileo says that philosophy or nature is written in the great book which is ever before our eyes, the universe. But we cannot understand it if we do not first learn the language and grasp the symbols in which it is written. The book is written in mathematical language, and the symbols are triangles and circles and other geometrical figures, without whose help it is impossible to comprehend a single word of it, meaning the universe, without which one wanders in vain, as through a dark labyrinth. So this idea that if I want to understand the physical world, I have to understand and be able to grasp through my senses and through the use of my mind and reason and through math, how that's going to happen. So this is what's going to be going on at the time. Now, this is all the rise of empiricism and the scientific revolution is eventually going to lead to secular humanism, which is not, like I've said, a necessary outcome. This is not what has to happen, but it is what does happen in a lot of cases. And this is going to be the fact that man becomes the center of the universe, but God is removed from that picture. So man becomes, this is not a new idea, by the way. The Greeks and Romans had this idea too. If you want to see how central this was to Greek and Roman ideas, all you have to do is go back and read the first line of each of the three Greek great ancient epics. Every one of them starts with, "Tell me, muse of the man of many ways. Sing to me, muse of the wrath of Achilles." And, you know, sing of the hero in arms and fighting. Every one of them focuses on a man. The Bible, on the other hand, in Christian and Jewish thought, its epic, the Bible, begins with God. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And this is radically different kind of orientation. And what secular humanism is going to do is really going to be a return through the practices of the Renaissance and a return to understanding of Greek and Roman ideas. Once again, we're going to adopt this humans being the center of the world without God. And the way that we're going to do this really is through rationalism, or it's kind of what we would consider to probably what you most of you might know is the idea of deism. And this is the idea, rationalism and deism, is that the universe, all of it, not just the natural part of it, but everything. Not just what you think of as gravity and things like that, but even how people interact. And even our interactions with others, how even the things that we would think have nothing to do with this kind of rationalism, they're kind of emotional or other outside of the realm of this, all work in a way that's logical and objective. And that therefore, if they're logical and objective, as a man's mind is logical and objective, so they say, it's possible for man to understand every single thing that he experiences. And if he cannot understand it, therefore it's not real. And it's not worthwhile. And that all of this can be expressed, obviously, in a mechanical kind of terminology and through the use of mathematics. And this is going to eventually lead to the rise of kind of the religious, although rationalism is a form of philosophy, so it's like a religion. It answers the same types of questions that a religion would answer. It's deism is what we typically think of as doing this idea of mechanicalism. Deists would say that God obviously created the universe. He's the author of first and final causes. So he set everything in motion and he knows where it's going to end. But everything in between, it's kind of like a watch. This is the picture up here. It's kind of like a watch. He's created the watch. It's vastly intricate. It's rational. It works according to the laws that he's established that we can understand. And that he set it in motion and he knows where it's going to stop. And he just kind of walks and steps away and it just runs by itself. And we are able to rationally and logically understand this using our reason. So the Enlightenment is what the Enlightenment is going to say. Now, it's important to understand that unlike people that maybe are rationalists or secular humanists say that they are against religion or that they're, you know, they are religion. That's the big thing. It's not irreligion. It's not non-religion. It's just another religion with its same sort of ideas and the same sort of beliefs that all religions have. Just gives you a different explanation for them. So that's the important thing to understand about Enlightenment. So let's go on to the next slide. Another thing that the enlightenment is going to do, even more than all the other things that have come before it, it's going to be this continued rejection of past authority. This is a picture of during the French Revolution, which really is the, in a lot of ways, the height of the enlightenment being carried to its logical conclusions. In Notre Dame Cathedral, what they did is they tore down all the crucifixes and everything, and they erected an idol to reason, and they made it the Church of Reason. And here they've enthroned reason in the cathedral, and they're worshiping reason as a god. So, it's a religion. So, what it's going to do is, and what the Enlightenment, because it necessitates, I have to understand, I have to experience authority, I have to experience it through my senses for it to be real and then logically understand it. What it does is it rejects revealed authority. So the scriptures are out because they are revealed authority. We can't trust them because I can't just experience that reality in itself, in my senses, and know that it's real. It rejects revealed authority and elevates the truth of discovered truth. So truths that I discover are more real than truths that I accept by authority. So you would see this kind of idea in Quaker thought, which is kind of a lot of they reject revealed authority and move towards kind of experience, discovered truth. This also leads, I think, very, very importantly to a, and we're going to see this in the next section, but it leads to a sort of historical snobbery in which we believe that because all of history then is a building of understanding and revealed truth and experienced truth, that now is the greatest time ever. And everybody before us is just a bunch of dark, stupid hillbillies, if you want to, you know, that kind of idea. They don't know anything. They're a bunch of bumpkins, and we are the pinnacle of human existence. And this is going to lead to the great dogma or thing that the Enlightenment passes on to us is this idea of the hope of progress. The Enlightenment breeds this idea because we can experience truth and we can gain it through our senses, we can understand the world, we're able to take the world and progress and get better. Now, this is not necessarily a Christian idea. This goes against a lot of Christian ideas about how we should, how we view ourselves. And man's ability to, well, we'll get to that in a second. So here's progress. This is a painting from America. Americans take up this theme very great, especially in the latter part, in the middle part of the 19th century. So here's progress sweeping across the prairie as the people move across it, being personified as a kind of like a god in Greek and Roman terms. So it's the belief that through man's rational ideas and his practices, that evil and the various problems of the world can be overcome. And basically what this does is it's going to take the traditional Christian hope of heaven and this new creation, and it's going to change it from this new creation that we are waiting for to this present creation that we can create for ourselves. And that's going to be actually taken up by Christians. There's a whole form of view of the end times that kind of revolves around this idea of kind of progress. We can create the second coming of Christ here, and that's going to be very prevalent in the time period after the Enlightenment. That's going to be the heyday of that kind of view and that kind of idea. Now, this is obviously all the things that we've talked about, man's ability to understand the universe, this idea of progress is obviously in stark contrast to the vast majority of traditional Christian ideas that deal with the fallen nature of man, man's ability not to understand and fully grasp reality because of our fallen nature. And also the fallen nature of the world itself and man's inability, apart from this outside work of Christ, to come into our lives and into the world and do anything about that. So this obviously stands in stark conflict to traditional Christian ideas. So we can move to the next line. Here's a picture of Voltaire. Voltaire would have been a smug little smile on his face. Would have been one of the great Enlightenment writers. Frenchman who spent most of his time outside of France because, strangely enough, it's the Catholic countries that are the most hostile to the Enlightenment. Catholic countries where they are much more in, have much more of an ability to enforce practice and belief in religion. And I think have a better understanding of the dangers maybe of the Enlightenment a little bit earlier than Protestants do. are able in a lot of ways to get rid of a lot of these guys, although it's not going to help France or any of the other, a lot of the other Catholic countries. But what we're going to have is the creation of a secular theology, deism, right? We've already talked about the transfer of the expectation of heaven. And what we're going to end up having is this conversation, because we're moving in directions that are not traditionally Christian ideas, traditional Christians are therefore going to be marginalized in a lot of ways from the intellectual conversation and the idea. And so what we're going to have, even though Christianity is going to flourish after this, in a lot of cases it's only going to flourish in ways that are either going to blatantly reject this, but that's going to be much rarer than ways in which it accepts some part of this modern idea of the world and the way that the world works, and it's going to accept certain parts of it, and it's going to use those, in a sense, to flourish in the modern world. And that's, we're going to talk about that more next week. So what is the state of Christianity at the time that all this is going on? You notice this is, this, none of that really has to do with a lot of Christians. All those guys, especially the big Enlightenment thinkers, the majority of them are not going to be Christians, or at least any way that we would consider them to be Christians. The state of the church at the time is that we have this sense of after the Reformation, after the energy of the Reformation is kind of spent, and it's spent in these wars of religion that take place throughout the latter half of the, in the middle half of the 17th century, about right before all this scientific revolution and everything gets going. Christianity goes through a period where they're fighting all these religious wars. We fight them in Germany, we fight them in England, we fight them in France. And what this leads to is a kind of disillusionment with religion just in general across Europe, because we've just had all these wars that are fought, hundreds of thousands of people killed, dying of starvation, kings murdered, everything else like that. So we have a lot of just people are just willing, let's just all get along and let's not question anything. Let's just, if this is where this kind of thing goes, let's not worry about it. So and I'm going to talk about here the three major strands of what I would consider to be Protestant Christianity. So Lutheranism, Anglicanism, and Reformed or Puritan theology here. I'm going to look at each one of these and then look at their attempted solutions for this. So in Lutheranism on the continent, and they're all going to kind of intertwine and mix together throughout the course of this. So Lutheranism is going through a period of Lutheran orthodoxy or neo-scholasticism, in which they're trying to enforce a kind of uniformity of practice. And they're also using kind of Aristotelian logic and different things like this to debate Catholics and others who are challenging Lutheran ideas in Germany towards the end of, after the end of the Thirty Years' War. This leads to a very stagnant, kind of just monolithic church that a lot of people with inside of Lutheran are going to react against. The same thing kind of happens in Anglicanism as the Puritans have kind of left after the Restoration and the Glorious Revolution. We have the ability for anyone that doesn't want to be a part of the Anglican Church to kind of leave the Anglican Church and go form their own church or do whatever they want. And so within Anglicanism, you just have a lot of just kind of stagnation. The same thing even happens in Puritan America. By the time we get to two or three generations after the original Puritans, what you have is you have the original Puritans even wondering whether their children will be worthy heirs to the heritage that's being passed on to them. Will they understand why their parents and their grandparents went and crossed the ocean and went over here to live or rebelled against the king and did all these sort of things? Will they understand that? And what you end up having in New England at this period, at the time, the period that we're going to be talking about, is stagnation. Puritan church practice had kind of, which had been, kind of just to give you an example of what I'm talking about, to become part of a church, a congregational church in New England, you had to give a testimony in front of the whole congregation, not unlike we do here, of your personal salvation experience, how you were saved, how that all that happened. By the time period that we're getting to and talking about now, that practice had been abandoned in the majority of the churches. And even not only were they allowing people to be members of congregational churches in New England without this sort of personal conversion experience, they were actually allowing them to take communion in the hopes that that communion then would do something to prompt that conversion experience. So we see we have a period of decline in all these places. So it's really a kind of a lull. And at the same time that the Enlightenment and everything is getting going, this stagnation is happening within the church. And so each one of these is going to have its own method of renewal that we're going to talk about now. And that's really the story of the beginning of modern Christianity, is this story of renewal. And there's three forms I'm going to talk about, and each one of these go in order. So Pietism within Lutheran within the Lutheran tradition, Methodism within the Anglican tradition, and then the Great Awakening really within the more Reformed tradition in America and in England too. So those are the three ways that we're going to be talking about this. We're going to talk first about Pietism. Pietism begins in Germany in the time period after the Wars of Religion. And it's going to be begun by a guy by the name of Philip Spinner. There's a picture of him, kind of an odd-looking guy. But he's going to have spent time in the Reformed churches in Strasbourg and in Geneva, and he's going to come back after studying there, back to Frankfurt, where he's going to be the pastor of the big church in Frankfurt, and he's going to be convinced that Orthodoxy is destroying evangelical Lutheranism. So this vital, living kind of gospel-centered Lutheranism. And what's doing it is this idea that it's not creating the right kind of practices. I'm not seeing the works that I should see if the people around me are converted in the way that the church is looking. So eventually, in 1675, he's going to write a book, The Earnest Desire for a Reformed for the reform of the true evangelical church. And he's going to lay out kind of his plan for how this should work within the Lutheran church. These are the problems and this is how we should fix it. It's really like a reform movement. So we should have diligent private Bible studies. He started one in his own house that met. And this is going to be a hallmark of both Methodism and other things like this. This sort of private, individual, small group studying of the Bible. The need for any sort of intellectual, and this is important because this is going to be really the area where all of these movements are going to move away from a rationalistic view or just a rationalistic view. So it's important to intellectually understand that Christ came and died for you, but that's not enough. Right? Just having a rational assent to Christ's work isn't enough. It has to be accompanied by something more. And for Spinner, that was accompanied by good works. And that's going to develop on as we go on in the other ones. It's also going to improve clerical practices for the clergy and different preaching style. This is another thing that had happened and where the Enlightenment and sort of this neo-orthodoxy and other things like this had developed in that the preaching style was very intellectual. And what we want to have, instead of this intellectual kind of logical, rhetorical form of preaching, we want to have a preaching that aims at converting the unconverted within the church and then exhorting those who are within the church to doing what they're supposed to do. Some sort of real preaching that's going to have effect. And this is going to be enormously influential and it's going to have the same problem that all of these movements have. It's going to radically divide the church into which it comes. Joe, you're going to have people on one side that hate Spinner and other people that are vastly influenced by him and accept his beliefs and begin carrying them out. Spinner's going to go on and become a big person within the Lutheran church. He's going to go on and become the personal kind of pastor to some of the leaders of Germany. But his followers, after his death, are going to be very big in spreading his beliefs all over central and northern Germany. They're going to found the University of Halle in Germany. This is going to be, eventually it's going to be merged with the University of Wittenberg, although they're not friends at this point, since Wittenberg's more of the Orthodox German view and Halle is going to be the Reformed German view. But people like George Mueller are going to be at Halle in the next 20 or 40 years. And so they're going to be influenced by them if you know George Mueller and his work. But they're going to form these religious educational institutions to train the pastors. But the most important area that his influence is going to be spread on is through his godson, Heinrich von Zinzendorf, who's the count. He's a count. He's a nobleman. He's going to study at Halle. And the way that this is going to happen is really Zinzendorf is going to take in a small group of wandering Moravian Christians onto his estate. So he's a nobleman. He has vast estates in Germany. And the Moravians are what's left of Huss's church. And they've kind of existed underground. This group has kind of wandered all around Europe trying to find a place to settle. They come to Zinzendorf. Zinzendorf says, yes, come. Settle on my land. They found a town called Herrnhut. And this is where they're going to live and found. Now, things aren't all good with the Moravians. They end up fighting and bickering amongst themselves, each other. Zinzendorf has to step in and kind of calm everything down. And what ends up happening in the midst of all this is a revival breaks out in Hernhut. And everyone, they call it this, they learn to love each other, is the language that they used. But this work of the Spirit, and this is what another thing that's going to be a marked kind of differentiation between the rationalist and this new school that's going to develop, is this: the work of the Spirit is going to become important as an experience that's going to be necessary. So this is going to go on. The community is going to spread, and they're going to become the first Protestant, among the first Protestant missionaries, or the first Protestant missionaries, however you want to look at this. And this is going to be the beginning of the Protestant mission movement. It's also going to be the beginning of revivalism. And people like Wesley, after his conversion and his time in Georgia, are going to go to Hernhut and meet with Zinzendorf, and he's going to be deeply influenced by the Moravians. Actually going to be converted at a Moravian prayer meeting. So that leads us to Wesley. Methodism is going to be the answer, very similar to the Moravians and Zinzendorf and German Pietism, and that he's going to seek a counter-argument posed by the Enlightenment, not by rejecting the intellect. The intellect is still going to be necessary in Methodism, but by emphasizing the hearts and the motions of the non-rational. So he's going to emphasize this sort of counter, right? It has to be both. It has to be both the heart and the mind. It cannot just be one or the other. So Wesley is going to be the 15th of the children of his father. They're going to have more children after that. During his time at Oxford, he's going to be part of the Holy Club that's going to be founded by him and his brother Charles and their friend George Whitfield and a number of others, in which they're going to systematically try and find out how they can be holy, live this life, trying to do it systematically. Can we systematize this? And this is where they're going to get the name Methodist from. It's from the jeering comments of their fellow students, although Wesley wasn't a student at the time. He was a teacher at the school. And eventually they're going to go on and they're going to become missionaries. They're going to go to Georgia. Georgia had just been colonized by James Oglethorpe just a few years before this. So Charles and James are going to go across on the passage across. There's this storm, the mast of the ship. Think about it. You're going to travel across the Atlantic Ocean on this teeny tiny ship. By any standards, this ship is tiny. Not very seaworthy. The majority of, sailing across the Atlantic was not a pleasant experience for anyone. Wasn't safe, wasn't nice. And so the mast of the ship get broken off. Everyone's freaking out, except there's this group of Moravians on board. And they're just sitting there calmly singing hymns and praying. And Wesley is deeply influenced by this. There's something that they have, obviously, that I don't have. Well, his time in Georgia is a failure. He becomes engaged to this lady, Sophia Hopke. He's persuaded to get out of it by a friend. And this is going to be the story with John and women. It's not going to go well for any of his relationships with women. But he is deeply hurt when she marries someone else. He ends up refusing her communion and her husband communion. And this leads to a big controversy. He's actually arrested and tried, and there's a hung jury, and so he escapes, with his reputation badly damaged, back to England. And it's at his return to England that he becomes in contact once again with some Moravians. And it's at an Aldersgate prayer meeting that he lists his conversion experience, and what he talks about is his heart was strangely warmed. In the evening, I went unwillingly, he says, to a society in Aldersgate Street where one was reading Luther's preface to the Epistle to the Romans. About a quarter before nine, while he was describing the change which God works in the heart through faith in Christ, I felt my heart strangely warmed. I felt I did trust in Christ, Christ alone for salvation. An assurance was given to me that he had taken away all my sins, even mine, and saved me from the law of sin and death. And it's after this time that he's going to travel to Hernhut to meet with Zinzendorf. And he's going to come back and he's going to begin his work. And Wesley's work and the work of Methodism is really going to be, it's very odd. Because Wesley doesn't want to leave the Anglican Church. He wants to remain part of it and seek to renew it and revitalize it. But the structure of the Anglican Church isn't what he needs. And so he's going to create we might call them parachurch organizations or something like that. But he's going to create these societies, is what he's going to call them, in which he's going to appoint ministers, eventually over 500 by the time of his death, of lay ministers who are going to go around and preach. The majority of the preaching that he's going to be done is going to be outdoors. It's going to be done to the lower, what they would have called the lower orders, just the poor. who didn't typically go to church, they were unchurched. He's going to preach to them. And he's going to, we talked about the lay preachers, but what he's going to do is Methodism is going to seek to bring the gospel to these people. And it's also going to affect, try and influence their lives and make them more morally right. He's not without his theological controversies, just to be honest. He has a conflict with Whitfield, his close friend, over doctrinal differences with predestination. Whitfield is a Calvinist. Wesley is an Arminian. Wesley ends up publishing a sermon in which he blasts Whitfield's views. Whitfield is obviously offended by this, but they end up being good friends for the remainder of their lives. During the midst of this, I'll just tell you the story. This is a great story about Whitfield. Not necessarily about Wesley, but someone came to Whitfield and said, you know, George, do you think that you're going to see John in heaven? Because, you know, you're having this big theological difference. You know, is this essential? He said, no, I don't think I will see John in heaven, because I think John is going to be standing so close to the glory of Christ that he's going to be obscured from my vision. Like, that's how close I think John Wesley is going to be. Because John Wesley was an extraordinarily holy person. Just this idea of, you go to the next page when we look at his legacy, 200,000 miles plus that he traveled on horseback back and forth across England. In a time when this was not, in a time when he would go to cities and he would be persecuted by mobs and pelted with stones and things like this for bringing the gospel to these poor people. 40,000 sermons that he preached in the open air to these crowds of people. And he's going to provide through this vast counterweight, both in England and eventually in America, where Methodism is really going to spread and take hold, to this sort of rationalistic idea. And he's going to do it among the poorest and the lowest of people. Well, he's going to breed a tradition of revivalism within this. So that's kind of Wesley's legacy. All right, if we move on to the Great Awakening, this is going to be the revival, like we said, of a stagnant church, and it's going to be its offer to the question of rationalism through an insistence that conversion has to be more, once again, than just intellectual assent. Like both Pietism and Methodism, the Great Awakening is going to be this sort of, as Edwards says, it's not just going to be intellectual apprehension, but true faith must move beyond the rational and affect the will or the heart of the person involved. Oh, so some characteristics of the Great Awakening. This needs to be understood before we start talking about it. You shouldn't understand the Great Awakening as some sort of unified event. It happened in the 13 colonies, and the 13 colonies are not in any way unified at this time, nor should we think about them being that way. It's not a unified event. There are going to be things that sort of tie it together, and that's why we call it this one thing, and it all happens within about 20 years worth of time. But it's not going to be some sort of unified event the same way that, say, the second or the third Great Awakening are going to be much more unified event, because they're going to take place inside a country. The revival among is going to be a revival more among established churches and not reaching out to the unchurched, although that will be a part of it. But the majority of what we're going to be talking about with this is going to be a revival among a church group. So, and it's going to be, for the most part, not a movement, like I just said, to reach out, although that's going to be part of it, and that's going to happen with people like Whitfield when Whitfield comes along. But Edwards' preaching is going to be done to his church. And the majority of Whitfield's preaching, in a lot of cases, is going to be done by churches that invite him to come and speak at their church and things like this. So the history of the awakening. It's going to begin in 1734 in Northampton, Massachusetts, at the congregation of Jonathan Edwards. He's going to be the son and grandson of congregational ministers. He's going to enter Yale at 13, graduate 4 years later at 17. He's exceptionally bright in his time as a student. He's writing about atomic theory, natural philosophy, theology. He's very, very broad and well-read across all things. He's going to be among the greatest, if you go here, the greatest American thinker of his generation, and possibly one of the greatest American thinkers ever. He delivers his sermons in a calm style. He's not going to be given, like Whitfield is, to more forceful manners of preaching, and he's eventually going to be forced to leave his congregation, but we'll get back to that in a second. The revival is only going to last for about a year and a half, and eventually it's going to end when a number of people in his congregation, including his uncle, undergo some sort of religious experience but don't get converted out of it and commit suicide. out of this feeling like that they are doomed to hell. So this is going to happen. Now, eventually, though, the revival in his church, news of that is going to make its way back to England. George Whitefield, who's at this time doing his thing, preaching outdoors in England, is going to hear about it. And he's going to come with Edward's help, because Northampton is one of the largest and wealthiest churches in New England at this time. So they're going to bring Whitefield over, and Whitefield's going to begin a tour of the colonies. It's going to begin in Boston and move to Northampton. And revival is going to break out again in there. And this is going to lead to really, this is the time period when Edwards is writing Sinners in the Hand of an Angry God and other things like this. Eventually, though, he is going to be forced to leave his congregation over differences of practice in regard to communion and church membership and different things like this. And he's going to go and become a missionary to the Indians. And eventually move from there and become the president of what will become Princeton and die of getting a smallpox inoculation, which he was a big fan of. So he decided to go ahead and do that to kind of persuade other people to do it. And it backfired. He died. So good idea, just a bad practice at the time, I guess. So that's what's going on. Now, the course of the revival after him, Whitefield is going to be the guy who, if anywhere we're talking about any sort of unifying influence, is going to be George Whitefield's travels. He's going to make 7 different journeys to America alone, and 13 different times he's going to cross the Atlantic Ocean at a time when he even once was pushing it. So he's going to do it 13 times. He's going to begin preaching in the north. He's going to travel to the south, and he's going to spread his revival with him all the way from Massachusetts all the way to South Carolina. In fact, he's going to be the first recorded white person to travel from New York to Charleston on a horse. First person to do that. So that just kind of gives you his dedication just to travel anywhere that someone needs him. There you go. He's going to become friends with Benjamin Franklin. Benjamin Franklin is going to be, he's short and cross-eyed, which people actually thought was a symbol of divine favor. Man, to be cross-eyed back then, that would have been the time. If you're going to be cross-eyed any time, that would have been the time. And you know, God really loves this person. They made him. He was very short, maybe 5'3", 5'4", but he had a big, huge, booming voice. And the stories are that his voice could be heard for up to 5 miles. It has to be, because there's stories of him preaching to 20 or 30,000 people outdoors. Actually, Franklin, who was his friend, went to a number of his meetings, although he never converted. They were friends, and they disagreed about a number of things, and they wrote, but they were always friends. Franklin published many of his sermons, promoted his revival meetings and everything else, because Franklin thought that they were great, just for other people, not for him. But Franklin actually went to hear him speak and then walked away until he could not hear him anymore. And then thought about how far he had walked away from him, and then tried to calculate what the radius of that circle would be, and then how many people could fit inside that. And he said he could probably fit over 30,000 people in there. So he had a big, booming voice. And he prepared areas for his coming advance by using handbills and printing technology and things like this that Franklin helped him with. And he was one of the, just like, obviously like Wesley, was one of the great travelers of his age, crossing the Atlantic 13 times. Traveling to Scotland 15 times, traveling to Ireland twice, preached over 18,000 sermons. So a great, great missionary. He's going to die at a relatively young age in the New World, and then be taken back to England and buried. Now, there are problems with the Reformation. We should not, and there's problems with all of these movements. All these movements are eventually going to lead to schism. Now, in the Great Awakening, this is going to be between what's called old lights and new lights, is what we typically had in Congregationalism. Old side, new side in Presbyterianism. And what this are people that accept the awakening and those that don't. And a lot of those that don't eventually are going to move into Unitarian belief, especially among the Congregationalists. But in the new lights, some of them are going to move more towards Baptist beliefs later on too. But this is going to happen everywhere. Methodism is eventually going to break off from the Methodist Church. Lutheranism, in a lot of ways, is going to form a unique kind of group. This Pietist movement is going to form this unique group that's not going to be accepted by everyone else in Germany. It's also going to lead to social tension. The Great Awakening will, more than other places, although Methodism does too, to a certain extent, especially in the south of the colonies, where there are official religions that, like Anglicanism in Virginia, where the people who are experiencing the awakening are being moved outside of Anglicanism. And they're being moved more towards, this is where we typically find the greatest growth of Baptists, early Baptists in the New World, is going to be in Pennsylvania and in Virginia and in other places in the South after the First Great Awakening, because they're going to be driven out of the older congregations like Anglicanism into these new congregations. They're going to be illegal and they're going to be persecuted because of this. James Madison is actually going to be the lawyer who defends a number of Baptist ministers during this time period, future president of the United States. And it's going to lead to a lot of push for freedom of religion in the United States. It's going to be one of the big driving factors is the revivalism and this tension that it kind of causes socially. But great things that the revivalism brings as well. If we go to the next slide. And these are going to be educational institutions. Every old, just about educational institution in the United States other than Harvard and Yale is going to be founded at this time by, not everyone, but the majority of them. So Princeton, Columbia, Brown, Dartmouth, Rutgers, the University of Pennsylvania, all come out of this period. And this is because the majority of these institutions, especially, are in the North, and therefore they're Puritan-based or congregationally based, and that's very important to Congregationalists, this idea of education. And that's not going to change with the revivalism. Revivalism is not going to be a move away from intellectualism. It's just going to be adding on this other necessary component to it. Also, missionary movements. The first missionaries, Protestant missionaries to Indians and to African Americans are going to come out of the First Great Awakening. So African Americans really had not been evangelized before the First Great Awakening, but Whitfield and others and Edwards and others are going to go to Indians, are going to evangelize them. And then this continued tradition of revivalism. It's going to be just a kind of one of the big hallmarks of American history throughout the next coming. I mean, you can even talk about, there was some debate about the Fourth Great Awakening, which took place in the, you know, in the 40s, 50s, and 60s in America. So even as late as that we're talking about, and we definitely talk about three anyway. So that's kind of the history of it, and we're going to look next time, next week we're going to be talking about how Christianity coming out of this is really going to, even though it's made this counterpoint to kind of rationalism, is now going to kind of accept some of the ideas of rationalism and what that's going to do to the church, and we're going to look at that. Any questions? I mean, we don't have probably a lot of time, but any questions real quick before I end? All right, well, if I don't, thank you guys. You're dismissed. Appreciate it.